It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out at this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front, and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th. Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. And this, once again, is a very special edition brought to you by the fine folks over there at Punk Rock Bowling. Today on the show, huge guest returning to the show, Bill Stevenson. You may know him from Black Flag, All or the Descendants, a bona fide punk rock legend, headlining one of the days of Punk Rock Bowling, and I'm very excited for you to hear this one. This is a good episode. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with me, hit up the email address, turnitoverpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker, normally, not this one, extraordinaire, well, he still helped out on my end, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this show. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left 4 Damien. There is a YouTube page, an Instagram page, a Facebook page, and a TikTok page, all for Turn It Up Punk. All those can be found at Turn It Up Punk on those platforms. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that we have this show going up twice a week. Doing pretty good at maintaining that. Twice a week you can hear this thing, and they can follow along. Sorry, I'm distracted because this one's going up a little late because I've got this incredibly painful injury that I had to go to the hospital for in my quadricep muscle. And it is very painful right now as I'm trying to get through this thing, but we'll get through it. We'll get through it together because you got to hear this episode. I played a band. We were called Fucked Up. We have some brand new singles. Well, one's brand new. But the another one's on streaming. Born Annoying and Cops, you can check out on streaming right now. Or you can order them along with a lot of other good stuff over at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, thanks to our friends at Punk Rock Bowling, Bill Stevenson is here. That is right. The legend is back on the show. I've interviewed Bill 4 times for various things. Some released, and then actually one or two has yet to be released on their various platforms. But this is the interview I've been waiting to do with Bill, where I can really just sit down with him and nerd out. Bill can take over an interview. I've done some interviews with Bill where I lose control. Go check out that Turn Into Punk Classics episode with Flag. So this time that I was able to kind of sit down with Bill post-show, he had just come off stage with that Descendants Circle Jerks Adolescence tour that is, it's been going on for the last year or so. It's incredible. I saw it in Toronto when they were last up here. And so he was ready to chat. And chatted we did. I'm not going to ramble on. You're going to hear this episode in a second. Check out anything you can and everything you can by Descendants. And obviously Black Flag is worth a dive into. And all all tends to get overlooked, but all is incredible. And that is it. I will see you at Punk Rock Bowling. Descendants, Devo, Madness, tons of sideshows. You heard the ad off the top. I'll be there chilling. Hell, I'll even give you a blowback. And you'll know what that means at the end of the show. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Bill Stevenson on Turned Out a Punk.
Oh, okay. Then it wants me to press got it. Okay, got it. There, I got it.
Bill, good to see you, buddy.
It's great. It's great to get to talk to you.
It's been a minute.
Well, and to see you. I can see you. I mean, I can't see you, but I see like a video of you.
Yeah. Yeah, don't worry. I'm not
are
putting
you
any...
in a record store? Or are you one of those guys who just has like every record that was ever made?
I'm one of those nerds. I got a problem. Like I got an albatross that my children will have to deal with one day. But at this point, it's a testament to not losing my virginity till I was 20. You know, like
really. You know, it's okay. In Norway, they have this thing. I'm not sure how they say it in Norwegian, but it's called the Norwegian death cleaning. And so they're always kind of going through their stuff and discarding any extra stuff so that I guess because they don't want their heirs to have to like dig through all their crap when they die. And so because you mentioned, you know, you're leaving this big pile of poop for your kids or whoever. But it's like, yeah, I think I'm trying to keep my thing where it's sort of like, okay, well, there's dad's stuff over in the corner and, you know, and that's it, where they're not just like going through stuff for like a month after I died. Cause you know, that it already sucks that you died and then to leave them with this big pile.
But then I'm of two minds of it too, because as much like my mom passed away a couple of years ago and I had to go through that process of like every single artifact, every single item they touched hurts when you're trying to decide whether to keep it or throw it away. Right. Like it just, everything's got
me.
So like trying to spare your kids from that. But then at the same time, especially someone like yourself, like you've done a lot of cool shit and like, hopefully you're holding on to some of the copies of these records.
Come
for the kids.
I mean, I have like one of every album or whatever, you know, one of every like t-shirt that doesn't suck. And, but I mean, just cause like, because with my dad, I had to do it in phases. So like kind of right when he died, me and my sister, let's say we got rid of like half his stuff. Okay. Then maybe a year later, I'm going, well, okay, what? So then I got rid of like half of that half of his stuff. So then a couple of years later, it's like, well, you know, he's not coming back. I mean, you're holding on to his stuff because you're trying to hold on to him. But he only lives, you know, in your memories, in your heart. And so, okay, then I got rid of half of that half. And I keep doing that for like 20 years now, you know. You keep cutting it in half.
That's a good way to do it, too, because then it's not like everything at once. It gives you a moment to kind of hold on to things. Like, I feel like that's a healthy thing to kind of hold on to. This shit, this isn't healthy at all. This is someone else's memories and someone else's past that I'm clinging to desperately.
Yeah, but that's part of like, what if your kids listen to, like they open up the Germs album and they listen to it? I mean, that's like, well, okay, well that mattered. Mm-hmm. Where they won't hear that in their world, they won't hear that. They won't hear the Germs.
Yeah. No, I feel like if one of them, I got three. So if one of them gets into this stuff, this will all have been worth it.
But yeah.
If none of them do, then shit. But anyway, Bill, this is not about me.
And then to where now I've pared it down to like, okay, well, those are like my two dad boxes, mm-hmm. You know, and then I got like my two mom boxes and that's cool. You know?
Yeah. Like I definitely, like there's stuff that I have with my mom that I go back to and I look at these items and I'm like, you know, it brings you back to a place. Like that's what these things ultimately are, is sort of like a time machine to a moment And
yeah, because me and my sister, we learned a bunch of stuff about my mom, because my mom led all these different whole lifestyles, you know, and she abandoned us at one point for a bunch of years. And my sister and I, we, you know, through going through her writings, little shit on post-it notes, a little shit on napkins or business cards with something on the back of it. And we kind of figured out, oh, okay. So in 1977, she was in Morro Bay. Okay. Interesting. So we've kind of pieced together some stuff from that. Yeah.
It really does give you insight into your parents going through their stuff. And like you're saying, like just finding stuff scrawled on the back of things and little notes and it humanizes.
With me and my sister, we found brothers and sisters.
Whoa.
That's what I'm saying. My mom had a whole situation. You know what I mean? So yeah, we found brothers, sisters, cousins. Wait, we're like, wait, who's that? You know, it's like some baby picture of whoever. And we're like, well, who's that? So, right?
Yeah. Well, you kind of touched on it in Filmage, where your family life was fraught. You know, I don't want to get emotional talking about it.
Yeah, don't get me riled up, right? Everybody knows they just have to go bing, and then I go, aah! Yeah.
Well, but it's interesting in doing this podcast how many of us were brought to punk because we were looking for, maybe not looking for, but we were coming from a weird family situation. And this beat provides a weird family in a lot of ways. And it has, it seems like, from the very, very beginning. Like, you can talk to some of the old Cleveland people, some like the first wave of LA people. And this seemed to always provide like a family for people that didn't necessarily have what they needed from the one at home.
Yeah. But I think, you know, I don't consider myself, you know, unique in that way. I think that quite many people's home lives are less than typical, or, you know, or other than typical. So I get that, but I do remember going to the first few punk shows I went to, you know, which was with Frank and his older brothers, cause they could drive. Me and Frank couldn't drive yet. And we'd go up there to like the Mask or those, you know, those places. And I remember going, I don't know if I was completely conscious, but I was kind of, okay, this is where, these are all people that they kind of don't have another place to be. Like, they sort of don't have clubs that they're part of, or they're not on the football team, or they're not a cheerleader, or they're not, they're just kind of, they're here, and there's like 100 of us, and we paid $5, and like the Go-Go's and the crowd and the weirdos are going to play, and it's everyone's like family right now, tonight, on like a Wednesday night in some shitty thing in Hollywood. And then we were all family for those 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, you like, cause you grew up knowing Keith, right? Like, since you were like 8 years old.
Yeah. He's my oldest friend at this point. Crazy, right?
He's the best. Like to me, he's the definition of a lifer in punk. Like, I saw Off a few months ago, and I was like, where's Keith? And they were like, oh, he's in the back. And there's Keith backstage after playing the show, huddled up trying to sleep on like a little tiny couch. And you know, he's been doing it for God, how many decades now?
Yeah, it's interesting with Keith and I, because my relationship with him, you know, it predates punk rock by a long bit. He was like in high school and I was maybe 7 or 8, you know, at the fishing tackle store. And then he would start, once we got to be a little bit better friends, he would start, we'd get to talking about music. And let's say I'm talking about Kiss or something. And he goes, and he's like, well, Billy, Billy, you should check out this thing. And who knows what it could be? It could be the Stooges. It could be the Sweet. It could be the Faces. It could be the Seeds, mm-hmm. you know, the Kinks. It could even be the Cars, you know, but it's like, you know, you should check this out. And he kind of, as punk rock came, he had already prepped me on like pre-punk enough to where when punk came, I was like, okay, I'm cool for this. Yeah.
Do you remember him talking about, like, cause he saw the Stooges right on that LA last LA stand that they had and like saw the Dogs, like saw like all this stuff. Like he's getting into it as it's kind
of slaughtering the Dogs.
No, the Dogs, like from Detroit, you know, the Dogs.
Oh, the Dogs. Oh, I don't know the Dogs.
Slasher Face was their song.
I don't know it.
They formed in
68. I thought you meant Slaughter and the Dogs.
Love them too.
Yeah. I don't know the Dogs. I've not heard, Keith's not ever talked to me about seeing the Stooges. We never had that conversation.
He saw them on at the Whiskey.
He could sell some frozen squid and anchovies. Hooked.
Yeah. No, he, it's funny with that, with Keith, because he saw, like, he saw all that stuff and he's still like as enamored with this music to this day, but I don't think he's as enamored with the fishing stuff anymore.
He never was. Keith wasn't a fisherman, but his dad owned the store, so he worked there. It was a family business. Keith hated fishing. Still does.
What about the last? Do you remember when first finding out about this band? Like Dave Nolte obviously was part of the early Pagan Babies, right? Pre-Descendants.
Okay, so I want to say Dave Nolte was in my Spanish class and he told me to like talk to this guy, Frank, that, you know, has a band called Descendants. So at the time, Dave Nolte kind of was the bass player of Descendants, but he was really trying to focus himself on The Last, which was another band that went to our high school. But so I met Frank and we hit it off. And then Frank told me all about The Last. I don't think David didn't really tell me about The Last, even though he was in The Last, but Frank did. And Frank worshiped The Last. And since Frank's the guy that really dragged me into all this, because we had music and fishing in common. Frank was a big fisherman. So we were like peas and carrots. And then he turned me on to The Last. And if you know those early Last songs, it's like, wow, this is, it just was. And I'm like, well, these guys, they live like six blocks from me. How could somebody that wrote this great of a song live six blocks from me? So I just became enamored. And every Descendants, I mean, we're Descendants. It's real. The Descendants things, it's a real simple formula. It's one third The Last, one third The Alley Cats, and one third Black Flag. That's it. It's so simple. It's like we were just obsessed with these bands. You could throw a little X in there. You could throw some Germs in there. You could throw all kinds of things in there. Seeds and Kinks and Animals and Beach Boys, you could throw, but I mean, really, if you get right down to the core of it, because the Alley Cats, you know, they had that Batman thing that we laid at the, you know, that was like, they were just the masters of that. And, you know, Diane Chai on the way.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
It's funny because I've heard you talk about it too, because, you know, you tell that story about finding that acoustic bass in the garbage and writing.
No, the acoustic bass was my grandpa's. My mom gave it to me.
Okay.
The acoustic guitar.
Yeah, the bass, but like some sort of
the bass. Yeah. But the bass, it wasn't an acoustic bass. It was a hollow body bass.
Okay.
It was an electric bass, but it was a hollow body. And so I'm saying because it's a hollow body, like it made noise. Mm-hmm. I could record it and I could record the acoustic guitar. And it was like, I swear to God, 2 weeks after I pulled that bass out of the garbage, I wrote Myage and I showed Myage to the guys, you know, and I wrote Bikage and Gene is Dead. And those are all bass things, you know, that with Myage, you got the Myage, every part of the song is a bass hook. And Bike is just the one. I dug out of the trash.
That's funny because, like, you think about punk, it's so much of it is weirdly like bass driven. And I, like, you talk, I even heard you talk about writing stuff with Greg in Black Flag, and he was playing the bass on things. I think, I forget what record you guys were writing together, and he was like playing bass instead of guitar when you guys were writing it. You think about the Ramones and Dee Dee writing stuff on the bass, like, it really is like a real strong bass driven thing to punk rock. And I guess that leaves the guitar free to kind of do whatever it's going to do.
Yeah, definitely. Some bands more than others. One of my favorite bands, it's just for Carl and Stefan and I, this band is so special to us, which is Generation X. And that first Generation X album it was really Stefan who put that album in front of me and is like, this is the greatest record ever in the world. And he pointed out everything great about it. I mean, yeah, I had heard Your Generation and 100 Punks and Ready, Steady, Go. I had heard all those songs, but he really put that album in front of me. And what he would always talk about with them is, like, he would always say, four guys with bats. There's no dominant people, even though they had Idol. Idol didn't really, like, know that he was Idol yet. You know, he was just one guy with one bat. And you got Durwood and, you know, and each of the four of them, and Mark Laff, it was like four guys with bats and the bass, meaning what I mean is the bass is like equal to everybody else. Whereas in so much of rock, the bass is this subservient thing, this kind of warm glow that fills up the room. You know, it doesn't have its own singing voice. And with Generation X and with the Alley Cats, and with Descendants and like so many other bands, you could probably name 50. The bass was like really a thing. And it just seemed normal to me that if people are going to show up in the garage, you know, three times a week and practice, they should all have it like an exactly equal voice with one another. And that's like that four guys with bats thing. That was something Stefan really was really keen on.
That's awesome.
Well, so when we got going and we did that blue record, you know, Descendants All, and I feel like you can really hear the four guys with bats. You can hear the Generation X, like on Coolidge. Coolidge is like straight up a Generation X song. I mean, like everything about it is, we just, you know, that's just, it was like really important to us.
Well, cause that's the brilliance of the Descendants the whole way through, like even way before that record, like you do hear all four parts of it being equal. Like it's not a band, like as much as Milo is an icon and there's like sort of this, you know, caricature mascot logo of,
yeah, that's them. The visual thing though, yeah, that's, yeah, not the audio thing, yeah.
But even beyond that, visually on stage, it's not like it's necessarily the Milo show as much as it's all four of you kind of like occupying your own space as much as it is in the music.
Well, Tony came in and he was so hot on like that. Okay. That band, the Flyboys.
Yeah.
And they had that. That song, Square City. I think that one's called. And then with Diane Chai from the Alley Cats, he worshiped her. That record we did, Ninth and Walnut.
Yeah.
So that song, Nightage, that's about Diane Chai. So it's a double entendre. It's about like hit her bass playing and how much Tony just coveted it, but also like he had a massive crush on her. So that's like that I'll never make it through the night thing. That's like about the Alley Cats bass player. Yes.
You know, she's related to the McDonald brothers.
Yeah. I mean, do they keep up with her?
No. Like when Steven was on the show, he was like, yeah, like we're like cousins somehow. And I guess they've met a few times. I'm trying to remember. It's been so long since we did that episode. But yeah, I got to re-ask him. But they're related to her, which is mind-blowing to me.
I'm going to, as soon as I get off this thing, I'm going to text Steven.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I mean, I've known Steven since he's fucking 11 years old. And I've known Diane, like we always end up like sharing practice places with them and stuff with the Alley Cats. So they're always like just with us, kind of.
They're like didn't mean to get off. Sorry, huh? I didn't mean to cut you off. Sorry.
It wasn't important.
I was going to say like the last, I feel like the Alley Cats are another band that's kind of underappreciated from that first LA wave or LA area kind of wave of punk bands.
Well, you can find the flyers, you know, you can find the flyers where it's like the last headlining over like every band that we'll talk about the whole time we're doing this. You can find flyers where the last is headlining over them, and you can find flyers where the Alley Cats are headlining. Our first show, Alley Cats headlined, the Plugs played before the Alley Cats, Black Flag played before the Plugs, and we played before Black Flag. And that's kind of that's what I grew up into, was like Alley Cats were the king.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, like it's interesting when you talk to people from LA, and I guess it changes very quickly as these eras kind of fall into each other, but yeah. Like Screamers, the Weirdos, the Alley Cats, like these are the bands that actually were
flesh eaters.
Yeah, you're right. Like the focal points.
The Bags.
Oh yeah, the Bags, definitely.
The Suburban Lawns, the Germs, the X. Yeah,
but I feel like Germs and X, I guess because of Decline of Western Civilization, are kind of
right.
Like
that put certain bands forward. Yeah, more forward than other bands, right? And all right, and the Alley Cats aren't in that, or the last. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, it's point. Well, it's interesting, like how that kind of like, especially for people outside that scene, became like the version of history that is taken out.
Yeah. It's weird because I remember when they were filming that. You know, a lot of it was filmed down at the church, and they literally would be like, it's like, you know, at our practice room, and the lady would be like, Bill and Frank, you guys are in the shot, like literally making us get out of the shot because we don't have a blue mohawk or whatever. It was like, oh wow, this is interesting, you know.
What did you think of that film when you finally saw it?
I think I've only watched parts. I just watched the parts. So I could see the Germs videos and the Circle Jerks videos and the Black Flag videos. I don't think I've watched the whole movie.
Yeah.
Maybe I have. Or plus I had to watch those scenes with Eugene, you know, where he's like, well, you know, it's all this pinup shit. It's the old people in the buses and shit. You know what, Eugene's part. Those are pretty great.
Oh yeah. Well, that thing has become like the, one of the most bootlegged, watched, shared videos amongst kids all over the world involved in this music.
Is Eugene or the whole movie?
The whole movie.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Like every character in that has become iconic, you know, like the but it's interesting because who's not in it, and then just what, and I guess also like bands that didn't have records that came out, right? The Screamers never put out a record. And
I mean, there was just so many bands, like fuck the Crowd, Rhino 39.
Yeah.
Agent Orange used to just blow us off the stage every time they'd play with us. The Adolescents blow us off the stage every time they played with us. Fear's in the Decline, right?
Yeah, Fear's in the Decline.
Yeah.
One band I saw that you played on an old flyer that I've never heard anyone talk about really, but it's huge with record collectors, is Aryan Disgrace.
Oh, I don't know that band.
They opened for you guys, or maybe you guys even played really, really early on. And they were on Mystic Records. They had a 7-inch.
Oh, Mystic Records.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Do you remember meeting the Reactionaries for the first time, and Watt and D Boone?
Yeah. I mean, we played that first show with them. The Reactionaries played. But I kind of more befriended them when they were the Minutemen. Like, so after, right around the time when the Paranoid Time single was coming out. Because we ended up, at a certain point, we were all sharing a room. Descendants, Minutemen, and Black Flag, we were all sharing a practice room for maybe, let's call it a year. The cops would come in and just kind of be like, you have to get out of here. Like, we don't want you in this town. And that happened like a lot of times. So the timelines get blurry, but I know somewhere in there, they took my mom, like my Afghan that my mom made me. It was black and gray and red. And they got my Afghan and they got my pink snare drum that I recorded Milo Goes to College with. The cops got all my like little childhood shit I had, you know, fuckers.
Yeah. That's another thing that's come up a lot is how much the cops kind of went after the punks in LA.
Yeah, they would just, no matter where, we would find some little weird place and we'd put, you know, foil in the window or board up the window so nobody knew what we were doing in there. And they'd somehow, they'd always find out about it. It was like their hobby was to not let us be bands.
Especially you guys. Like, I mean, when I say you guys, I mean SST and
yeah.
Kind of.
No,
like,
yeah.
I wonder if they thought it was like a Manson thing. Because it was a bunch of young kids grouped together, living together. Like, why would kids be doing this? Like, what the hell are they doing in there?
It was so weird because, yeah, everybody took it the wrong way. Because you had that thing you're talking about. But, I mean, too, some of Ray's art, Ray was into that. That he liked to fuck with that stuff, with the Manson stuff. But, too, on the other side of it, like, because the band's name is Black Flag, like we had SWP, like Supreme White Power, come after us and like actually straight up try to kill us because they thought we were like a black movement. And we're like, holy shit, can just everybody just fuck off so we can play our music?
It also feels like it began at a certain point to develop into its own thing, kind of separate than punk. Like obviously it's punk, but it became its like own brand of it a little bit.
Are we talking SST or Black Flag or
SST in general, like as a thing?
Well, it's because we were all down in the South Bay and we weren't part of like the Hollywood thing at all, and we weren't really part of the Orange County things. We were just people like from, you know, Torrance and San Pedro and Hermosa. We didn't have shit in common with, you know, television or the Ramones or whatever. We had nothing in common with those bands.
But it's also cool because none of you guys sounded the same. And if you like, especially that, as even on the whole way through the label, like none of the bands really ever sounded like, it was like more united by a philosophy or maybe like a work ethic than it was by a sound, like a lot of scenes in punk.
Yeah. Or maybe just united by not being united by, you know, people kind of doing their own thing.
You guys all live together, right? Like it's all pulling in one direction. Like you.
Not really. I mean, different people would end up sleeping on the floor of different people's practice rooms. And there weren't clear lines between like, say, homes, practice room, offices, record label, recording studio. Those things were all kind of blurred in, and so yeah, you never knew who. But there was a point where it was pretty dense with like us, Minutemen, and Black Flag, and maybe a little bit of Saccharin Trust thrown in there too, where it was pretty like sardined up in there. Yeah.
And then you probably, because it would also have like bands like Husker Du or the Meat Puppets and all these people begin rolling through at a certain point, right? And staying.
Yeah, sure. Because that's how it was. Like if we played DC, then we sleep on Ian's floor. And then if Minor Threat comes and they sleep on our floor, that's just a given. But it was too, it was easier because like in the smaller towns, there was kind of like one band in each town. So it kind of made it easier. Oh, we're in wherever. Well, we'll sleep on the Necros floor. Oh, well, we're in Austin. We'll sleep on the Big Boys floor. That was pretty simple back then. You knew, everybody knew, you know, it was close. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much do you think your time in Black Flag informed the way you kind of approached all? Like, I think the Descendants obviously predates your experience in Black Flag, but
yeah, but it was all happening at the same time. What I mean, because even at the church, like we shared our practice room at the church. It was us and Black Flag. So we were, I mean, we were all together. It was all, that stuff was coming into me by osmosis. And I mean, when I was, I don't know, 14, 15, you know, I used to come down there and I would pester Greg to have him. And this is, I think, one of the big reasons why Flag works so well is because when I was real young, Greg showed me how to play all those songs on guitar, like, I mean, like in slow motion, bit by bit. So I at this point, I may be like the only living human that knows how to actually play those songs the real way. And so we were all very close, you know, and Greg was generous with his time. Back then, you know, that Greg from back then, that was like a different Greg. He was generous with his time. And, you know, we'd sit on the floor and he'd show me how to play all those songs. And I would go to Black Flag practice. I literally would just camp out. I would bring like a sleeping bag and I would just listen to them practice. And then eventually I'd fall asleep. And then I'd wake up the next morning and go to school.
But like, I mean, like, it feels like that era of Black Flag versus the era where you guys are in it and you guys are playing like, I don't know how many shows a year. It's like so storied and I maybe, yeah. And it's like everything's in service of being in this band. Like you're, and it feels like that's what all, at least in filmage, that's what really comes across with all is like, it was all about all and you guys, the world was structured to tour and be in this band to tour. Records were put out so the band could tour.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. That, well, that model mm-hmm. of like, well, we sleep on the floor of our practice room. There may or may not be any hot water. There may or may not be a shower, probably not be. And so, well, why not go on tour all year? Cause like, well, don't you miss being home? Well, but what's home? I sleep on the floor of my practice room. At least on tour, maybe we can meet some people and sleep at their house after the show. Maybe they'll cook us breakfast. Maybe we can get a shower. So it was like tour had a better place to stay than home. Yeah.
It's also kind of maddening being on the road too, right? Like it's like
you lose, it's easy to lose. I feel like the best description of this is that song Milo wrote the lyrics, which is called Days Are Blood on Enjoy. That's really for tour. That's what tour's like. And it's still like that. The tour bus and the hotels, it doesn't change it that much. It bleeds into itself for a whole bunch of reasons. I think for me, the top reason is that I have to be like a guy, like I have to be like somebody at 10 p.m., but I'm not somebody at 10 p.m. I'm a morning guy. I get up at 4 or 5 a.m. I like to go to the beach. I like to go fishing, go surfing, go swimming. That's who I am as a human. But nope, you got to be somebody at 10 p.m. And it's like, well, where my bedtime's 9 p.m. How am I going to be somebody at 10 p.m.? So you end up like on a backwards schedule. So I when we're done with sound check in the afternoon, I go to sleep. And then I wake up at, you know, 9 p.m. and I drink like 4,000 coffees. And so then when 10 p.m. comes, yep, I'm ready. Somebody. And it's like, good morning, you fuckers. And I just play the shit out of those drums, right? And then, but then what? Well, I had, you know, 15 espresso, let's just say. Let's round it off. So then what? Well, now I'm up till 9, 10 a.m. So then I'm backwards. So then what actual day is it? And that's like that song, Days Are Blood, I think really captures that, where it all just bleeds into this thing. You start the tour and then you like slither around and through it. And then you then the tour's done and then you're done. Oh, shit. Well, now what do I do? Okay, yeah.
Yes, but that come down after the show, even without the 15 espressos, is is fucking hard. That's why I love the weed, because that helps me come down. I know that's not your vibe, but
I've never really had much luck with that. I've never really liked feeling stoned, you know. I mean, I admit that this right here has some tequila in it. I admit, but because it's late, you know, and I am going to try to go to sleep soon.
Yeah, she needs to come down.
But I mean, I don't really like being stoned. I don't know.
So was weed like a big part of Black Flag? Like process of weeding out? Were you like, did you smoke weed then at all or no? Because like you're famous.
That's not what it means.
It has nothing to do with weed?
No, it's a really, Greg came up with the title, and I think it's pretty condescending, I guess you might say. We would do these records, and you know, it was like, well, what are the punk rockers going to think of this? And it was almost like we took the reverse thing of like, well, we needed to kind of cull the herd anyway, you know, so this will weed out. This record will weed out all the
posers,
the just kind of punkers, you know, that just want to hear punk rock. You know, they don't even care what it is or anything. This will get rid of them. So in a way, it's pretty kind of sarcastic or ironic, but it's kind of like, yeah, this will weed out all the you know, this will truncate all the gangrenous appendages. Yeah, yeah.
That was the first Black Flag CD I bought. It cost me $30.
Oh, Lee, that was your first one.
It nearly weeded me right out of being into punk, Bill.
Sure. I'm sure it would. Well, that's like if you get into Ornette. If somebody says, hey, I want you to get into jazz, and they give you an Ornette Coleman record. Say. Well, you go, well, no, I don't like jazz. But if you got into Ornette Coleman, like through the right channels, and you'd go, okay, I see what happened. Charlie Parker died. And okay, now here's this guy trying to kind of do something more than what had already been done. And then you kind of get it. That's the thing. The one thing the decline did is it made, or I don't know if the decline did it, but whatever, punk rock got super popular in LA. And there's just all these like bonehead, jarhead, jock people showing up at the shows. And we were just like, oh, gross. So it was almost like we were trying to put ourselves away from those people. And I'm speaking to more like for Greg and not, I was a young kid. I didn't really, I couldn't have such sophisticatedly formulated thoughts about any of it. I was just happy to be there. Like I can play drums and like, that's cool with me, you know.
Because those sentences were fast, did you guys have a lot of those sort of like tougher, you know, violent hardcore kids coming to your shows? Was that something you guys had to contend with?
You know, yeah, some, but it didn't seem to be as, I mean, you know, like I've been beat up at my own show before by the attendees of the show, you know, like I played shows where like skinheads were throwing, you know, like a folding metal chair from out in the club, throwing metal chairs on the stage at us while we're playing. So it's just like, yeah, I've seen a lot of different kinds of things in that way. Descendants didn't have too much of that.
Yeah.
Hardly any. Well, because the melody scares them away, because those sorts of folks, they're probably tone deaf anyway, right? And so the melody will scare them away. So that was our way of weeding out, is we have melodies. Ooh, melodies.
Well, it also feels like it eventually just kills the scene in LA for a number of years, where people come on and talk about how, like, yeah, eventually people moved away or...
Or people quit going to shows. I think I quit going to shows. It may not have been conscious, but I was like, well, I don't want to go get my nuts kicked in to where they're bruised, where I can't walk for like a week. I don't want to do that again.
Yeah. I don't blame you on that one at all. What about the Nerves? Were you a fan of that band?
I don't know so much about the Nerves.
It's interesting because the last, I feel, and the Nerves would have been kind of, you know, sniffing around the same sort of thing too at the time. But I guess it's like there's a lot of bands in LA, like The Quick and stuff too, like that are kind of.
The Quick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that band.
Wait, I think I bought my, not like my big, huge gray drum set that's like my real drum set, but the drum set before that. I think I bought that drum set used from The Quick.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think, because I'm pretty sure the kick drum had like The Quick on it. Or if it wasn't The Quick, then it was something that makes me think that it was The Quick.
Well, that would, because that is like Los Angeles proto-punk, right? Like that Quick, the Zolar X, Imperial Dogs.
2020.
2020, that band's fucking amazing.
Yeah, 2020. That's the thing. If you see the flyers, you'll see the last 2020, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it feels like Descendants could have fit into that. I guess you guys are faster, though, than a lot of those bands.
I don't know. Plus, we were a little late to that party. Descendants, we just didn't get shows. Like, if Chuck wasn't nice enough to put us on a Black Flag show, then we just didn't have them. It would be like us. This is what it would be. Here's what it would be. It would be us and Rhino 39 and the Suburban Lawns playing in like the City of Industry in some warehouse. And there would be literally no one there, only like the bands that were playing and their friends. That's so funny that we developed kind of this kinship with the Suburban Lawns, who I think are just tremendous.
Oh, those singles are amazing.
Oh, fuck. Like, yeah. And because we were like the bands that didn't have anywhere else to play. So we all found each other and were like, hey, well, there's this rat infested asbestos warehouse in Carson where we can play. And we'll put one of our friends charge $5 at the door. It was like always that kind of thing. Alley Cats. It's weird. Once the Alley Cats weren't like the darlings of Hollywood, I don't really know how that all happened, but then we would end up on shows with the Alley Cats too that way.
Or, the Alley Cats. Oh, go on. Sorry.
Shit. I don't know. Rhino 39. I don't know. I can't think of
it. It's
some type of Agent Orange.
Yeah.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Alley Cats had a MTV song early on too, right? Off that first 12-inch of that LP. Yeah, because I've got a copy of it that's like featuring the MTV hit on the hype sticker.
Escape from the Planet Earth, or
yeah, it's like Blue and Black. I'm trying to remember the.
What's weird because they kind of like all of their when they were like the amazing band that I'm in love with was way before that album ever got recorded. Same with the Go-Go's. If you want to hear real Go-Go's, here's where you got to go. There's a B-sides or a rarities Go-Go album. It's called Return to the Valley of the Go-Go's. And on, I think it's, let's say it's a double album. On, I think the third side, there's like those original five demos that they had. It's How Much More, Lust to Love,
Blades, I think,
Cool Jerk, and they're all right there together. And you can tell because when you put them on, you just go, oh, I love this band. Because they were a punk band. And yeah, by the time their album came out, though, they weren't a punk band. They were like a pop band, you know?
Yeah, they would have had a, like everyone says, there should have been a Black Flag LP between Damage and My War.
Yeah.
There should have been a Go-Go's LP between the 7-inch and that.
Yep. Totally.
Speaking of My War, you know, like another thing people always talk about is side one.
We couldn't do it though because of the lawsuit.
Yeah. See, oh, yeah.
The problem.
And I guess there's that 82.
The closest you get to that is those, it's the backside of that horrible version of TV Party. But on the backside of that is I've Got to Run and My Rules. And that's an album like that would have made sense between Damaged and My War.
And there's also like a demo, right? Like a pre-My War demo session that's been bootlegged like crazy.
Before everything got so slow. Yeah, that's really good too.
Because like it's with My War, there's also that famous conversation about, are you a side one or side two My War person?
I don't ever do that though. I don't do like Beatles or Stones. I do Beatles and Stones, side one and side two.
But I mean, like to point out that there is a distinction sonically between side one and side two.
Not sonically, no. We just put all those dirgy ones on the back side. That's all. We put the dirgy ones on the back side.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting because I find not that the dirgy songs are on the B sides, but like with Milo Goes to College and I Don't Want to Grow Up, there's a distinct vibe difference between side one and side two of both those records.
For some reason, when it was vinyl, I think we would front load the first side of the vinyl with maybe a little more of the high energy stuff and then put the back side of the album with more like ballady stuff. And I know it's a small distance to travel between, you know, Suburban Home being high energy and like Gina's Dead being ballady. But at the time that seemed like a big difference, or with like, say, I Don't Want to Grow Up being high energy and then Silly Girl being ballady. I mean, they're to an innocent bystander, they're very similar. But to us, we always called them like in our band, we still do. We did it yesterday when we were playing. There's the rockers and the cheesers, you know, and like we did it yesterday because we were doing the encore and somebody said, well, let's do bop, 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 bop. And I go, no, we got to separate. We can't do three cheesers in a row. We got to go cheeser, rocker. Cheeser, rocker. So it's like you do think about it, but maybe you don't, or maybe it doesn't matter too, because like all your songs are between 190 and 210 beats per minute, every single one of them.
Yeah.
There's not a slow song, and there's not, maybe sometimes there's a fast song. I want to be a bear. I'm not a punk, you know, couple.
But it's weird because it ends up being all like the high emotional impact songs on the side two, which is also like the Modern Lovers LP. I think when you listen to that first Modern Lovers record, the A sides all
thing.
Same thing. It's got, and it's, I've always found the similarity vibe wise between that and Milo Goes to College and I Don't Want to Grow Up Too.
I'll have to go back and check that out. I'll have to go, you know, go back and listen to that album.
Oh, it's killer. It is.
Well, heartburn.
I tell you, that's the coffee.
Drinking kombucha.
I drink it all the time on tour.
I don't know. I think I get heartburn. I'm not sure.
100% you get heartburn from it.
Plus, I have all these supplements. Like,
holy.
No, it's a whole thing.
Oh my gosh.
So then who knows? You don't, when you have that many variables, there's no constant, you know. So I don't know, why do I have heartburn? Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you changed the way you eat on the road?
I feel like that's kind of always evolving, right? I mean, you don't just change it, you know. Well, 20 years ago I changed it and like that's how it's been for 20 years, but it's kind of always evolving. But I will say that I'm taking better care of myself now than I ever have. I mean, it's harder because I'm older and it takes more effort, but I'm putting in the effort. I'm putting in tons of effort toward my health. whether it be a diet, nutrition, exercise, just all of it, my health. Like I'm putting in an awful lot of effort. Yeah.
Because I think I was listening to an interview leading up to this where you're talking about the fact that you still deal with health issues. And it's not like.
We all do. I'm 60.
Yeah. It's wild that you're on the road still, though. Like, you know, and still it's cool that you're able to make it like.
Oh, but I'm playing my ass off. Yeah. Now, yeah. Go watch a video. Watch a video from like last night or whatever. I'm playing my ass off.
Every time you play, it's a sellout at the Drum Riser because every drummer wants to watch you play.
Yeah.
You and Mario, I find, are the two drummers. And for completely different reasons, it's like, I think people would want to see how hard Mario hits that snare drum. And people want to see how you get the two hits off the snare drum. I don't know anything about drums. So this is just what I picked up from overhearing drummers talk about you play.
I don't know. That's hard for me to speak to that. It's, yeah.
But it's like, I guess it speaks to how important this all was to music. The fact that like.
What about spit though? Like what about spit sticks?
Yeah, there's a lot of great drummers in it.
I know, but I mean, have you ever sat on the side while he's playing?
I don't think I've ever watched him on the side of the stage.
You should, because I don't know how much more they're going to do, if any, you know. But you should see. Oh,
I don't think they've come to Canada yet on any of this run, the last runs. It is a, I don't know, drum and bass driven genre, punk rock.
That whole when I got into it, I mean, you had DJ Bonebreak from Fear, Don Bowles from the Germs, you had Spit, you know, from Fear, you had Robo, you had Chuck Biscuits from DOA, and John McCarthy from the Alley Cats, and Jack from The Last, and you just everywhere you learn. Oh, and Carlos from The Plugs. Oh man, The Plugs.
Yeah, The Plugs.
Yeah. So that's you just had all of that, you know.
The Plugs are another band that I'd put up there with that Screamers last thing we were talking about earlier. That
nobody knows about them. Yeah.
And they play with fucking Dylan.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're in porno movies. Like they really have done all sorts of things in their career.
we rip off so much stuff from The Plugs though that we feel good about it. Like we're keeping The Plugs thing alive.
Yeah. What was the deal with Cruise Records versus SST and all being on it? Like, was that just like the new home for it, or like?
Well, Cruise is just a kind of an adjacent label that Greg Ginn started. So I didn't see it as different than SST, other than Greg said, "Hey, I'm starting a new label called Cruise," and I said, "Oh, okay, like I don't care." Yeah, so that there wasn't probably as much thought into it as you may have thought, or at least not on my side. He said, "Well, I want to put the All stuff on Cruise Records," and we said, "Oh, okay."
And then there's almost like, and I guess not a lot of the bands were on Cruise, but like Chemical People, Doughboys, Big Drill Car, Mega City 4. Like there's almost like a scene of bands that are doing, I don't want to say pop punk because obviously that's got such a connotation, but melodic driven punk rock. And there was like an international scene, it felt like, around that time that kind of sprung up.
Yeah, I don't think I know about it the way that you're talking about it. Well, I'm not saying that, like, okay, your thing, your impression of it might be completely accurate, but from where I sat, you know, that this being like my home, you know, like I slept on the floor of either record label, it was kind of like the same thing, right? So I didn't see it as a like a thematic difference between the labels. I wasn't aware of that, whether or not there actually was one.
Yeah, like I don't, and this is also me just talking out of my stoner ass on it. Like, I don't know if there actually is one either. I just have noticed
you seem too alert to be a stoner.
Oh, weed is My
Do you have the sativa kind or the indica kind or both kind? Or
that's made up. Sativa and indica was just two researchers operating independently, identifying two separate strains. Yeah, I don't I feel like it's just based on your physiology, right? Like
it's certain, made up.
Yeah. Indica and sativa, like they were one guy, Linz, I think, observed cannabis being cultivated and was like, oh, cannabis sativa, cannabis being cultivated. And then years later, another researcher was in India and observed a plant kind of growing by itself and it was stout. And he's like, oh, cannabis indica, because it's growing in India. And because of that, they kind of came up with these two categories, but there's not really, like, there's so many different types of weed. And then there's also no different types of weed, because hemp and the strongest stoner weed you can get are all basically the same plant at the end of the day. And it's just how it's bred and different variations on the same species.
Ah.
So, but this is how I smoke weed. This is like hash, but it's like they get rid of all the plant matter.
Oh, is that, do you use one of those volcano things?
I use this and a blowtorch.
A blowtorch and a pair of pliers?
No, and then you put a little dab on this thing.
Is that what you call dapping?
Dabbing. Yeah, dabbing.
Dabbing.
Yeah. Oh, okay. This is some real rhino shit right here. So
well, you know, rhino's not in any of that anymore.
I know. I went up to him last time when you guys were in Toronto, and I'm like, yo, man, I got this crazy dab you gotta try. And he's like, not into it. Not into it anymore.
Yeah.
I felt like I lost a great hero.
Comrade.
Yeah. What was the thing you told me about where people blow weed smoke in your face?
Oh, a blowback.
A blowback. That was it. I always thought it was called a blowy.
No, a blowback, because I've never smoked anything. It just seems too brutal. Like, especially now since I've had those lung problems, I've never smoked anything. I feel like I would be afraid to smoke something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
There's cannabis suppositories.
Well, but I mean, what, can I just do what you're doing?
You can do what I'm doing.
Oh, no, your thing has a blowtorch.
Yeah, well, I think it has a blowtorch. So it's either get shoved up your ass or use a blowtorch. It really comes down to that.
That's all I get.
That's all.
So no gummy, huh?
No, we don't believe in gummies up here. No. There's...
Oh, no, why not?
No, I'm just kidding. You can have a gummy if you want.
Oh, is it legal up there? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The whole country.
Whole country.
Worldwide.
Yeah, well, I mean,
countrywide.
Yeah, you can fly with it in your, you're actually encouraged now to fly with it in your carry-on luggage
domestically.
Yeah,
within Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to cross the border with it still. I think that would,
what if you're flying from like Canada where it's legal to Denver where it's legal?
You could still be fucked at the border.
How?
Because that border is federal jurisdiction.
Oh, and our feds aren't down with the program, right?
Not into it at all.
Right. Okay.
Not into it at all. Like, I actually had we'll get it.
Damien and Bill talk about weed. Yeah, that's great.
I people are listening to this podcast, they're like, you have this opportunity to ask Bill any question you want about music and you're wasting time talking about weed again.
Yeah, but what do you want? What are we gonna talk about? Like, talk about fucking Ramones or something. I mean, you know, like, it's good to just let it go where it goes.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. But there is, like, that's the thing, man. Like, you've had so many different,
wait, is, do you careers. Do these, do you do these taped, or is it like it's live right now?
No, it's taped.
Oh
yeah, yeah, no one's watching.
I was just curious.
It's just you and me. Don't worry.
I was just curious.
Yeah, no. I find I was with Keith and Jay Maskus and Bob Mold at a festival, and it hit me like, oh shit, all you guys were on SST. And it's amazing when you break it down, like, just how much music came through that label and how much music is still kind of, I guess, unheard or that was on that label. Like, it's just, it really was the underground kind of portal for a while.
Yeah, I think it was certainly one of the most important independent labels, certainly for rock. I mean, when I say rock, I think if it's like, if it's got a loud guitar, I just call that rock. Like, you can call it punk rock. You can call it metal. You can call it grunge. You can call it any of it, anything you want. But I'm saying, like, for all of that, for any of that stuff, like, they were just, yeah, hugely essential for all of it.
I noticed in filmage, Ray wasn't in it. Did you still talk to Ray at all, or just still?
I do. Ray's pretty, pretty reclusive. He's kind of keeps to himself. I mean, I'm not going to like say he's like a shut in, like extreme that way, but he kind of just keeps to himself, you know?
Was he the only guy that you guys had sing after Milo left, or was there other people that you kind of tried out in that spot?
Yeah, Ray was kind of teetering between being second guitar if Milo was up from San Diego, you know, and we were playing shows and Milo was singing, Ray would be on second guitar, or Ray would sing. Yeah.
Was there anyone else you had though to try out or sing for during that time period?
I don't think so. Not that I remember. No.
It's interesting how, like, important the vocalist of a band is, and just how much identity is tied to that person, and how, you know, because I guess with all, it's something that you guys kind of always, you went through so many different people in that spot, right? But it's like,
it's the is factor.
Yeah.
Mike Ness is Social Distortion. Mick Jagger is the Rolling Stones. And it's like, well, no, that's actually not true. And then you go back to four guys with bats, what we were talking about, four guys with bats. It's for magazines, you know, for magazines, radio stations, record labels, you put a face, you know, and in our case, we got that cartoon character. But, you know, you put a face and it's, yeah, oh, the Rolling Stones are on the cover of whatever magazine, but it's Mick Jagger. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's easy marketing. But when you actually get into bands and you know how bands really work, it's more like it's four people. It's usually more of a democracy, more of a cooperative.
Mm-hmm. It must have been hard for the various vocalists of all to kind of step in there, especially as it goes on, when by the time Chad's in there, because you always have like the last person to live up to, and ultimately you're still trying to live up to another person. Like, it just feels like there's a lot of baggage on a lead singer. And I'm obviously, being a lead singer, very sensitive to lead singer ego issues and the balance that it takes to get up there and do that. So I'm just fascinated by that with all the different guys that had.
Yeah. Well, with all, I mean, you got to think about who we had in the band. I mean, we just kept getting these amazing people. Anybody that heard that, you know, that Dag Nasty record, you know, Can I Say It? And it was like, oh, this will be that, you know, Dave will do just fine. You know, he'll come into this and he'll bring something into this that wasn't there before. And then with Scott, it's like, when have you ever heard anybody sing like Scott?
Yeah, he's got a crazy voice.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's got the high range, right? Well, yeah, I'm getting to Chad, but I'm saying, you know, and then Chad comes in and it's like, it to me, it's just like Black Flag. Like, we just kept getting great people. Cause to me, there was like, first era Black Flag, which would to me have Keith and Ron, but then when Dezo came in, all of a sudden it took a darker turn, like a more serious turn, and then Henry then even more serious. But I'm just saying, I think if you're I think it was Greg that once told me, you know, we said, well, when one door closes, another door opens. So anytime someone would quit the band or whatever, Greg would see it as an opportunity to upgrade. I learned that from him, and I don't, not to dismiss any of anyone I've ever played with, but I just mean, you know, I woke up in January 15th of March 15th of 1986, and I woke up and my band had quit. They were gone. There was no one there. I was sleeping on our practice room, but there was no hour. There was only me. Okay.
Yeah.
So I've rebuilt my band, you know, three times.
Yeah.
I had Tony on bass and Doug and then Carl, Frank on guitar and Ray on guitar, and now Stefan. So that's, I've always seen it as like a chance to improve things. And with the singers the same way. And I think, I feel like the singers saw it as the same opportunity. If we would have got someone super shitty, well, then that would be different. But I don't think we ever did that.
It's very much like, and obviously you guys are very different people, but it is very similar to Black Flag's approach and Greg's approach. Like, what is Black Flag at the end of the day, but Greg and various people at different times that made up Black Flag, and same with Descendants and All as one project.
Yeah. I mean, that probably gets down to, well, what are the essential common threads? You know, there's that scientific principle of, okay, well, is someone necessary, right, for a band to be that band? But also, is someone sufficient for it to be that band? And then if it's like Greg Ginn and your grandma on bongos, well, is that Black Flag?
We'll see. It's only a matter of time.
Well, what do you mean? We have been seeing, you know, seen it. You have an opinion on it.
I feel like it is because the person saying it is, right? Like, if you're like, it's almost like an auteur approach to band making, like sort of like, if you view the whole thing as one project, you're like watching someone navigate this thing in the various stages of their life. So that's what, you know, I think that's what makes it valid. But yeah, like everyone else, everyone has their own particular favorites.
I
think it was Jeff, when he was on the podcast, Jeff McDonald said that when Rollins came into Black Flag, he felt that Greg and Chuck were casting the lead singer that reflected the fan base and the way the fan base had gone. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
No, I don't think that's not my opinion. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with it, and I wouldn't say that Jeff or Steve are wrong. I wouldn't say that, but I would say it was more about like what it was really about was Dezzo really, he didn't really want to be the band singer. He wanted to focus more on playing guitar. And he definitely really didn't want to be the man's, like, you know, front man. And whereas Chuck was really adamant on wanting someone that was like really a front man that would rule the stage, you know, that would dominate, that would fucking. And so, you know, Henry came into it and it was like, oh, let's have Henry do it. You know, let's check this out. So I think it was serendipitous as opposed to maybe
you were contrived.
I know it wasn't like that. Nothing that was ever done with any of our bands was, you might give us too much credit for being like conspirators or whatever. No, it was kind of like, it was cool with Dez, but I think he just wanted a little more out of life than to just be the Gator. You know, we called him the Gator. Rawr, rawr, rawr. You know, because he joined the band and he lost his voice. And then his voice was just lost the whole time until he rejoined the band. So you got to feel for Dez, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think it's what you said about that. Finding like a guy that fit the mold of what the audience. That's never been that way. No.
Do you find there's a lot of that goes on with, I guess the Descendants too, but certainly Black Flag, where people put a lot of myth onto these bands, like the crazy practice sessions, how.
Yeah, the practice sessions. Those are the practice sessions are like, it's like we built the pyramids or something. Yeah. Yeah, no, those have been aggrandized to a level that now, mind you, I mean, we practice 5 days a week, you know, like we don't play around. I mean, right now I'm a 60-year-old man. I don't play around. We don't play around. We practice our asses off. But not like whatever, like 8 hours a day, 10 days a week, like that doesn't happen. And like that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think that's what also like, that's the thing that seems to unite all you bands is there was that incredible work ethic. Like you're about Husker Du.
We worked our asses off. Yes. We worked our asses off. We practiced back then, like, okay, in Black Flag and in the real heat of it, we practiced every day. Unless someone was maybe became too sore or, you know, where it was like, I needed to take a day of rest. Other than that, we practiced every day, but it wasn't 8 hours. It was like, maybe we go through the set twice, or when you're working on new songs, you practice longer because you're trying to come up with parts and, you know, but if you're just preparing to go on tour, preparing for shows, you know, you go through the set, like, you know, blast through the set, take a shower and go up to watch a band play. That was more the normal thing. Yeah.
Like with the Descendants and with most bands, the goal is to write music that people in the audience will like. Like, not that you're placating the audience or just giving them exactly what they want, but at the same time, like that's what we're doing, is we're entertaining. But like you're saying with Black Flag, at a certain point it was like about alienating the audience, weeding out certain people from the crowd. Like, what was the end game? Like, you're practicing for, you know, not 8 hours, but you're practicing every day, you're going on these crazy tours, and there's almost like a process of alienation of, well, I guess that's another SST reference, of the fan base.
I don't really know. I mean, I was young and happy to be there. So that part of it, you'd have to ask really Greg about.
But I mean, like, you're as a musician going out there, as a person, like going out to play these shows.
Right, but I was playing like things that I thought were pretty cool. I mean, given that all the material was coming in real, real slow and real sludgy, and then like, somehow marijuana had made its way back into the fucking world, you know, in our thing, which I, you know, and I mean, I like Sabbath as much as the next guy, but when I joined the band, I didn't, you know, I wanted to play Police Story, not Dirt by the Stooges. And so, although I love Dirt by the Stooges, it's the greatest thing in the fucking world.
Yeah.
We did a whole side of a whole album that was like Dirt by the Stooges, basically. And maybe that's cool. Maybe that's cool. Maybe Dirt deserves that much of a tribute. And I love those lyrics on Three Nights. And I love that song, Nothing Left Inside. I think Nothing Left Inside is a beautiful ballad. I think it's a beautiful song. And I almost think the slower it got, the better it got, really down there in the gut bucket. But I was trying to do things that sounded cool to me. Like that era of Black Flag, I would look at like the song My War, or I would look at the song The Swingin' Man. You know, to me, The Swingin' Man was, no band was doing anything like that at the time. Nor later, like, nor My Ghetto you know, or some of those things. There were things we were doing that were, they were cutting edge without being like, well, we're just trying to bum people out, you know, because Greg would always say, yeah, bumming the punkers. Like, like, let's bum the punkers. Let's bum out the punkers. The punkers, I don't know who the punkers are, but I mean, I guess it was everybody that likes, I don't know. It was a weird thing because there were so many thrash bands at the time. These just, and they're, you know, none of them could play their way out of a paper bag. And it was kind of like, I could see why it was maybe important to Greg to like try to separate us from those sorts of bands. I can see that. I can see this from, I'm a fucking grown ass man now. I see it from so many sides that back then I didn't see it. I just knew that like if Chuck and Greg said jump, then I say how high, you know. Yeah. Not in a subservient way, but in I trusted them fully. Mm-hmm. I trusted them. They're still, those are still two of my heroes, you know.
Well, and side two and all the sludgy stuff that inspired so many bands and like a whole subsect of punk and hardcore in the wake of that Black Flag. Like there's whole scenes of people that kind of were inspired by that shift to the slowness. But I've heard you talk about it before in other places, and I've heard Henry talk about it in other places that like your favorite Black Flag stuff is the other stuff.
Yeah, it was before Henry or me were even in the band. Yeah.
So to be there every night playing this stuff that you don't even have 100% faith in, like obviously you have faith in your parts, but necessarily the direction of the band.
Well, at the time though, I was just happy to be there. Mm. Right. So, and I think Henry was too. And Henry certainly brought a lot to that. Let's put it this way. Try to pull off the My War album with a singer that's not Henry.
Oh yeah.
Right. You know, so he brought a lot to it. He put his seal on it and his stamp on it. But I think looking back on it, yeah, like I wasn't really trying to be Black Sabbath. Black Sabbath was my favorite band since I was 12 years old. But I wasn't trying to be Black Sabbath because one thing is, it's probably more of a practical thing. I'm not good at playing drums slowly. Like I'm saying, I'm not good at it. I'm shitty at it. I'm good at there's a lot of kinds of drumming that I'm very good at. I know this. I'm not trying to be humble or falsely humble, but I'm shitty at playing slow. And so like, quit making me play slow because I don't fucking know how to do it. You know? So, you know what I mean? This is like way more on a practical level, not like a conceptual level or strategy level. It's more like on a practical level.
Yeah. But even though you're saying that, you're an incredibly influential slow drummer because of those records.
Oh, God. Because when you do hear like that on that, you know, on that, on Dirt, you know, and it's like, that's how you do that thing slow. Like, I don't know if they were doing heroin or whatever they were doing or like Sabbath, like on Sweet Leaf or, you know, Children of the Grave or like those things. Like I didn't do those things. I had never smoked pot. So I didn't know. I didn't feel that. It wasn't natural for me. I was like coffee guy, you know?
Yeah. Would you be drinking like the bonus cup and then having to go out there and play these songs?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know.
Bill, I don't want to keep you all night because you got to get to sleep, but I could punish you forever. I got like dozens of pages of more questions for you. And
dozens of pages.
Oh man, I got like pages.
Okay, so we've been an hour and a half. All right.
Yeah.
So let's go 10 more minutes and then we cut it.
Yeah, we'll cut it then. But then
now you can choose your questions.
Oh, I believe me. I can't. I can't choose. We'll just keep rambling like this because
no, but you can. I said 10 more minutes. You got your thing. Or I mean, you started this. You started this. Hey, let's end the interview.
Well, no, I did because I wanted to give you an out because I don't want to keep you all night. I'm like, I'm looking at you, bed behind you. I'm like, you got to go to sleep. I don't want to keep you here all day. This is my This is my fourth time interviewing you, too.
Is it?
Yep.
Oh.
First time you farted on me.
I'm in a Days Inn.
Nice hotels. I like Days Inn.
If it matters.
You could be, well, they're not sponsoring this podcast, but maybe you guys can get a sponsorship out of that.
Oh, you can do that?
Well, I've always thought, like, as a band, the things that you'd want as a sponsorship would be a gas company.
Beef jerky. No, I don't know.
Yeah, beef jerky. Just all the shit.
We used to joke it would be RID. You know RID?
No, what's RID?
How you get rid of crabs.
Okay.
It would be RID or that Quell oil, how you get rid of scabies, you know? Like we used to joke about back in the day, like, what do we wish we could be sponsored by? Be like, you know, duct tape,
yeah.
Quell oil, RID, Aleve or Advil, you know? Yeah.
Did you notice distinct improvements in touring over the years? Like, were there eras? Because, like, where it went, you're like, oh, wow, touring's this much better now than it was before. Like, I'm thinking, because obviously Black Flag,
well, DOA, in the early days, we made those improvements for ourselves.
Yeah.
So the first big improvement was going from just the van where there was like a loft in the back and you could lay on the loft. 2 to 3 people could lay on that loft, but the top of the van's like right here, you know, and then the gear would go underneath that loft. So that was like phase one. I mean, that was dirty business, you know.
So did you guys invent that? Like, who did you guys learn that from? Because that's still what people do for their vans, like build that.
Yeah. I don't know that we, you know, nobody ever invented anything. There was somebody that did it. But I mean, it just seemed logical.
Like, did DOA roll up with that? Or like, was that like, who brought that to punk?
I don't know. I don't know that DOA ever, by the time they came to LA, I don't know how long it took them to get down to LA. I don't know. But the second phase was like, get a trailer. You put the gear in the trailer, then you've got the whole van and you can take that loft. And instead of it being like this far from the top, you could put it in the middle. So there's like an upper loft and a lower loft, and you could fit like 4 people could sleep there comfortably, or like 6 if you had to. And that was a huge change. But I mean, we brought that change. Like, the scene didn't give us that change. That we made that change with like plywood and like a screw gun. But then for us, probably the next phase was that school bus we had, that gray school bus. But the problem with that, where each guy had their own bunk, but that school bus kept breaking down all the time. So the real phase was the white truck. So the white truck had 6 bunks in it and a little tiny, like a lounge area. And then the gear was in the trailer behind the white truck. And that white truck, that Caterpillar engine and that Allison transmission, it was that those GMC top kick, that truck never broke down for 15 years. That truck never broke. That truck, it never even sputtered one time in 15 years. That was the solution.
Well, because
then after that, then you move into like, you know, maybe where you fly in and then you have tour buses and that kind of thing. And that's where you're not doing your own driving. So it's just kind of been a little bit of an uphill trek toward comfort.
And that's still the progression bands do, right down to the design of the vans. And
I think so. I mean, if they want to work, if they just want to stay in their hometown, then they can do that, you know, but. Mm-hmm.
But did you notice a change, let's say, after Nirvana explodes and you have that alternative music explosion in terms of the way All was experiencing the road? Like,
no, because we had already taken charge of all of that. We had already bought the school bus by then. And we were like, we're doing this. We didn't even know what Nirvana was or any of that stuff. It's like, we're doing this and we're going to do it, you know?
We were also kind of like
our world then was really small. It was like us, Fugazi, and No Means No. That was kind of like our world in a way.
What about like, like the Doughboys or Big Drill Car and all these kind of bands that I look at as being.
They were doing like Van and Trailer.
Yeah. But I think they were like almost the, and obviously now it's quaint to say because everyone's a child of the Descendants, but they were like the original children of the Descendants, it seems.
And I don't know if they were, because when people, so many times when people tell me whatever Descendants or the like fathers of pop punk or whatever that shit is, and like especially when people talk about Green Day, and I'm just like, hello, have you heard the Buzzcocks?
Yeah.
Like Green Day sounds like the Buzzcocks. They don't sound like the Descendants, you know? And I think with a lot of bands, I mean, you got to remember the Buzzcocks were already doing it, you know? And so was The Last. And so was, you know, X and the Go-Go's and all these bands were doing it before we were.
But I was thinking about this today, looking at Descendants footage. What Descendants did is kind of like let you go up there and just be yourself on stage.
Come up in your street clothes. Yeah.
Yeah. And not like, like I love X. I love all these bands. I love the Germs, but they're all like, they're all affecting a pose.
That's true. They all had a look, right?
Yeah. No,
that's a really good point. Cause we just don't, I just still, for me, it's all about which stuff is the cheapest clothes and like that will dry before the next show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whatever I can rinse out in the sink of the backstage and then find some place to hang it in the van. And then I can play in it again the next day and it'll be sort of dry. That's the perfect stage clothes, right? I mean,
yeah. Look, or like when Milo had that innovation of wearing the water bottle.
He still has it. No, he still has it.
And that to me is like a fashion thing when you look at it, but it's also a highly functional thing. No, it's functional for him, but on anyone else, it's fashion, right? Like for you guys, it's function. And then for anyone else, it's fashion.
That's why it's kind of, he kind of as a joke now, his water bottle now, his strap that he holds on his water bottle, it's studded with like, what do you call those?
Bedazzled.
Yeah, he's got all these studs on his water bottle. Cause it's like, if people are going to think that this is, I might as well make it funny for them. If they actually think that I have this water bottle as a fashion statement, instead of me just trying to gulp water down in between songs, because you know, we don't stop,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, we don't stop between songs. And he's just like, so he just thought it would be better to have it on him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I think that's the thing that, obviously the music as well, but that's
people used to make fun of me and Henry. We had those, I mean, now they're called them like short shorts, you know, but those were just shorts back then. That's what a short was those were a normal PE short, and we could play and we could rinse those out in the sink. And in my drum hardware case, which is about, you know, this big, we could lay them, put my drum hardware in, and then put my shorts here and his shorts here over the hardware. So they're just there drip drying. The next day when we load in the gear, you pull out the dry shorts and you wear them the next day. And they cost like $4 at the sporting goods store. I don't know. People used to make fun of it as like some kind of fashion thing, but it's like, whoa, you're just so missing the point of everything about this. Cause I couldn't wear my chonies anymore. Cause when the Chili Peppers did that album where they had the chonies on or on their dicks or whatever that thing, then I didn't want to have my tidy whities anymore, because they did turn it into a fashion thing. See, for me, you could get 3 tidy whities for like $2.99 at, you know, and then I could rotate those if they weren't dry yet, you know. But then when the Chili Peppers did that on their album, I go, I can't wear those anymore. Someone will think I'm like trying to be like the Chili Peppers. I'd rather shoot myself, you know, and have somebody think that. So, but then we found those. It was above our practice room. It was a little tiny sporting goods store. And we went in there one day and we're like, what about these? They're fucking $4. And we each bought a pair and we toured in those for like 3 years.
It's amazing how the stuff that is purely functional gets taken up so differently, because like, yeah, those shorts, especially on Rollins being up there with nothing else on but the shorts, have become such a—
we had the same shorts on.
Yeah.
With they were $4. Like, that's what I mean. People are just totally not thinking about this the right way.
Yeah. As I say, one more question.
Take a look at me. Do you think I care about fashion? Look at Black Flag. Do you think Greg gets his clothes from the thrift store? You know, like, it's like, no.
Well, that's the great thing about punk when it gets to LA is because, well, hardcore specifically, is because it didn't become like, you didn't have to buy a leather jacket. You didn't have to buy X, Y, or Z. You have to have your hairstyled a certain way. You just do what you want to do and just be here for the music.
Well, you did, though, if you wanted to play at those Hollywood clubs, which is why all the Black Flag and Minutemen and Sacred Trust, all those gigs, they were these weird rented halls that we would find, these Moose Lodges, these Eagles clubs, these VFW halls, these places where we could find the owner and say, hey, well, can we rent your hall? We'll give you $200. And then we put our friend at the door. That's because, you know, the mask and fucking the club lingerie, they wouldn't have us. You know, they wanted to have nothing to do with us.
You guys played with the Germs, right? Like, you guys did cross over with some of that scene.
Only when the Germs would come down, you know, to play. Yeah.
You were the first guy to kind of hit me to how much deeper I should be looking at the Germs lyrics. The first time I interviewed you, you said you used to carry around the lyric sheet at school or had one in your locker for a while.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous how great those lyrics are.
They're a band that ever since I started doing the podcast, I've realized, though, is very, like every band, is multifaceted. And there's a lot of people from LA that were kind of freaked out by them and have been on the podcast and talked about how, like, it was like a cult in a way. And it was like,
like the Germs Burn?
Like the Germs Burn thing, or just like Darby had the girls that would follow Darby around, that would— Jerry H told Adam Parfrey told him that he got beaten up by the girls that used to follow Darby around at a Germ show one time.
And I don't know anything about this. So you're talking about, this is Hollywood shit, and I didn't know anything about this.
Yeah.
Kira probably knows.
Yeah, but that stuff, I guess, wouldn't have followed him to the South Bay when they would play shows there.
No.
It was like
with us, it was Saccharin. It was Minutemen, Saccharin, us and Black Flag. That's like kind of the little world.
Well, Bill, this has been awesome for my little world. And anytime you want to come back on here and talk about weed or punk or rock and roll, you're always welcome.
Or short shorts.
It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out of this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front, and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.